Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth in Movies. I'm Leila Latif.
I'm Laura Benning.
I'm Darren Richman.
On the show this week, a lesbian odd couple hit the road in Drive Away Dolls, a happy marriage falls asunder in Banel and Adama, and David Jenkins spoke to its wonderful director, Ramata Tulise. And on Film Club, more ladies are up to no good in Bad Girls Go to Hell. All coming up on Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So, Darren, lovely to have you. First time that we've ever kind of virtually met. How's it going?
Yeah, it's going well. Thank you very much for having me.
Absolute pleasure. For those who aren't aware of your work, do you mind giving a little intro as to who you are and what you do?
Yeah, of course. So I'm a writer and journalist. I've got a monthly column in the Jewish News. The last couple of pieces that may be of interest are about the passing of Richard Lewis and the Zone of Interest. I'm writing a book about my grandfather, who was an Auschwitz survivor. And on a very sort of different tone, I co-wrote a spoof autobiography of Pat Sharp.
A real Renaissance man.
Yeah, and I've just had a great commission from Little White Lies, which I won't say too much about, but hopefully will be going up in early April.
Very exciting. I mean, not an easy time to be writing about Jonathan Glazer. The internet does seem to have really run with that, with a lot of extreme reactions in many directions.
That is for sure. Yeah. I mean, just for the record, I thought the film was a masterpiece and the speech was entirely uncontroversial, in my opinion.
Wow. Laura, how are you? I was going to say an uncontroversial person, but I don't want that makes you sound a bit boring, which you're not.
You don't know what I get up to when I'm not doing this. You don't know. No, I think I'm fairly uncontroversial. Never got into any major Twitter spats, so I count that as uncontroversial. Good. Thanks very much. Recently spent a lovely 5 days up at the Glasgow Film Festival. That was my first time up there. That was really good fun. Saw lots of great films, enjoyed some great food. Glasgow's a lovely city, so that was the most kind of recent exciting film related thing I've been up to.
Gotta say, I mean, that festival looks amazing, but great food is not what comes to mind necessarily when I think of Glasgow.
I know, me neither, to be honest, but thankfully some insiders and friends took me to some lovely places I would never have found on my own. I think I had maybe the best cinnamon bun of my entire life in Glasgow, up near the Kelvin Grove Gallery, which I was not anticipating for my festival experience, but it was absolutely divine. I'm still thinking about it.
And we're about to go into another festival because I think BFI Flare starts today or started yesterday, but it's kind of, this whole weekend is all things BFI Flare. Are you going to be attending?
Yes, I'm going to a few things. Tonight I'm seeing a documentary called Lesvia, which is all about the island of Lesbos, the Greek island of Lesbos. And it's made by a filmmaker she calls herself a double lesbian because she is a lesbian and she is from Lesbos, and exploring the legacy of the island and its relation to queer culture, which should be really interesting because I don't know anything about it. A couple of highlights that I'm looking forward to are Chasing Amy, which was at LFF last year, where the director, who's non-binary, explores their enduring love for Chasing Amy, the Kevin Smith 1997 film, and it's kind of a reappraisal, and that's just, you know, an analysis, and that sounds really interesting to me. So looking forward to that one for sure.
God, I remember watching that film as a, you know, preteen and thinking it was so profound, and I suspect it isn't, but like might be interesting to go reflect on that again. I mean, I'm not being able to go and see very much, but I'm making time because I've got a friend of mine in a kind of comedy documentary sort of thing called TOPS, which is all about TOPS surgery and, you know, the sort of nuances around it, but it's all kind of framed as like a sort of parody of a breakfast TV show. I think it looks really fun.
Oh, that sounds fab. I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, films about transgender identity. They're showing Orlando, My Political Biography, which I originally saw in Berlin last year and just like blew me away. That was my favourite film of that festival. And, you know, I think it's getting a UK release this summer. But if there are any tickets left, which I hope there are, and you're in London, go see Orlando, My Political Biography, because it is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, definitely will do. And before we move on, Darren, anything that you're particularly looking forward to that's coming up on the cinema calendar?
That's a great question. I haven't even thought about what's coming soon. I feel like we're just coming to the end of the sort of period where I've been sort of going constantly and been very excited by everything. I was obviously very excited about one of the films this week, but we will get into the discussion of that a bit later. But no, there's, you know, there's nothing in the immediate future that I've thought, oh God, I can't wait to see that. So seeing lots of things in rep, I'm going this Friday to see Raising Arizona at the Prince Charles, which is a sort of childhood favourite that I've never seen on the big screen. So I'm looking forward to that.
That'd be amazing. I've got to say, doing this schedule, some really great weeks coming up in April. We were very excited about them. And then one really bad week. But I will not disparage, you know, films before I haven't seen them. But yeah, there is one which I think we're genuinely a little bit like, can we actually do this to someone and make them go and watch these films?
Hey, you made me do Jurassic World Dominion and Thor Love and Thunder, so maybe it's going to be me.
No, you're exclusively Chris Pratt. Next thing he does, though, I'm giving you a call straight away.
Heavy sigh, yeah.
But yeah, we should get a move on to Drive Away Dolls. Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member, who receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies. Drive Away Dolls follows Jamie, an uninhibited free spirit, bemoaning yet another breakup with a girlfriend, and her demure friend Marianne, who desperately needs to loosen up. In search of a fresh start, the two embark on an impromptu road trip to Tallahassee, but things go quickly awry when they cross paths with a group of inept criminals along the way. So, Laura, this is not necessarily what I assumed Ethan Coen's long gestating passion project was going to be. Were you very excited to see what he came up with Drive Away Dolls?
Yeah, I mean, an element of, yeah, curiosity and yeah, slight bafflement. I read that, yeah, this has been in the works from the early 2000s, and it came out of conversations with between him and his wife, Trisha Cook, who I believe identifies as queer. And it came out of conversations going back since then. And I think it nearly got made at one stage with the original title. We need to take a moment for the original title, Drive Away Dyke. And in reading the brilliant interview with Ethan Coen and Trisha Cook that Hannah Strong did for Little White Lies, they talked about how genuinely disappointed they were that the studio would not let them hold on to that title, which is not altogether surprising, but is a shame. I truly had no idea what to expect from this, but was just excited and curious to dive in.
What about you, Darren? Big fan of kind of the Coen brothers and excited to dive into into one of them's sadly mistitled film.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was interesting that they used the Scorsese's Irishman trick of actually putting the title they wanted at the end and just ignoring what they'd been told. Yeah, I was very excited. I mean, you know, in terms of big fan, I mean, they are my favourite filmmakers, certainly my favourite working filmmakers, although whether they will work together again remains to be seen. I was incredibly intrigued by this. I was intrigued by the trailer. Obviously, you know, you've heard talk of it for must have been 20 years or something. And I just had no sense of what this thing would be. You know, whereas Joel had obviously, you know, made The Tragedy of Macbeth, where that was a film where I kind of knew line for line what it was going to be. Here was something that I just did not have a sense of what to expect.
And did it kind of reach the lofty heights that you expect from your favourite living filmmaker?
I think it is safe to say it did not reach those lofty heights. I mean, the thing that I think in terms of understanding the Coens and Ethan in particular, actually, is they are absolutely obsessed with Bob Dylan. So Ethan Coen wrote a short story collection that is called Gates of Eden, named after a Dylan song. They're repeatedly on record as saying that this is the biggest kind of artistic influence on them. And I think there's many things they've done over the years I've always thought were quite Dylan-esque. They will never explain imagery. They're not interested in, you know, talking to you about the ambiguities of their films. They kind of give off a sort of Beavis and Butthead vibe, which is what he does when he's, you know, when Dylan is asked about lyrics, he'll just say, oh, it rhymed with light. That was why I chose that line. And so the thing about Dylan is that it strikes me that he has no interest in a lot of the kind of mythos around him. If he wants to put out a triple album of Frank Sinatra covers, he'll do it. If he wants to dress up as Santa and do a Christmas album, he'll do it. He'll put out albums where the cover, they've gone for like one of the first photos they've clearly taken that's just blurry and out of focus. He just, while everyone else obsesses, he doesn't seem to worry. And this strikes me as a completely kind of, for me at least, sort of inessential, frivolous, kind of throwaway film that is the kind of thing that Dylan would do. It's like everyone's looking to see, oh, what's he going to do after all these years and such a critically acclaimed filmmaker. And I think they've always been like that. They were always happy to do a Raising Arizona or a Big Lebowski or a Burn After Reading, as well as the ones that would be in Oscar contention. I don't think they like to be pigeonholed or thought that hard about, you know, this has to be a worthy, serious film. And this is certainly not a worthy, serious film.
Yeah, that's safe to say. But I suppose that's what I found curious kind of coming out of it, where I don't know if you agree, Laura, but like this didn't feel like something 20 years in the making.
No, it really didn't. and in a way, I don't know, for me, there's something kind of oddly endearing, and maybe this sounds strangely patronizing, but oddly endearing about a passion project 20 years in the works. And it's so stupid. Like, it's just so stupid. And I don't necessarily mean that in a derogatory way. And, you know, it's playing on kind of sexploitation films, and it seems to have sort of very deliberately, you know, some of the gags are very like crass in a way that's, yeah, kind of enjoyably stupid up to a point. And some of them feel more like sort of homages or references rather than actual sort of gags deliberately and designed to sort of make you laugh. I mean, I suppose I'm thinking about an early scene where you get like, you know, a tiny dog humping someone's leg. And I'm like, sure, that gag's been stale since God knows when, but I almost felt like, I'm not entirely sure, is this actually meant to make me laugh, or is this kind of a reference to the world of John Waters, the world of, I don't know, yeah, that kind of sexploitation genre. But yeah, remarkably stupid for a project that's been sitting on, you know, inside a desk drawer for 20 years.
I mean, do you think it was? I mean, yeah, there's certainly some kind of stale, almost like Pete Farrelly level gags in here as well. But I mean, did you find it funny, I guess, is the key?
In places. The sense I get in terms of it being a kind of 20-year passion project and in terms of where it kind of ranks in the Coen canon, the sense I get from sort of reading under the surface, I think this was Trisha Cook's baby. And I think Ethan, I guess, came along for the ride, pun not really intended. And so I feel like it certainly does not feel like a Coen Brothers film. It's obviously, you know, not a million miles from those slightly more wacky and outlandish ones. But, you know, they wrote a film early in their career in the mid-80s, just after Blood Simple, I think, called Crime Wave, a Sam Raimi film. And no one really cares about that film. When you talk about kind of Coen films, it's very throwaway. And I think it's much more, you know, it should be in the conversation with a film like that more than it should be in the conversation with No Country for Old Men or Inside Llewyn Davis. I mean, the transitions in this film look like they've been done on Microsoft Paint. It's insane. But I did laugh in places because there is something about the dialogue, particularly the way that the Margaret Qualley character has been written, that has, you know, something of the kind of Clooney character in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, this kind of sort of a fool who is incredibly loquacious and believes they're the most intelligent person in the room. So I did kind of, you know, I laughed in places, but I also felt that it was sort of interesting that he said he was the first one to kind of get bored of filmmaking of the two of them, and said he was actually bored of it and he didn't enjoy doing it anymore and didn't know why he was doing it anymore. And it seems that lockdown was the cause of him. He made a sort of Jerry Lee Lewis documentary that I think was essentially an editing job of splicing things together. And then this, they got back to work on writing this script. And you can sort of feel, I don't feel like it was a film that was kind of 20 years in the making. It sort of feels like it was an idea that was 20 years in the making. But actually, they started working on it properly in 2020 because they were bored sick, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, we all did things in lockdown that we shouldn't be held entirely responsible for. I mean, something that's kind of been an idea for like 20 years, when you've had such a change in depictions of queerness. I mean, like, Laura, did this feel dated in that sense for you?
I would say actually no, and that's what pleasantly surprised me. I felt... thing is, as daft as this film is, and you know, it wasn't as funny as I'd hoped. However, it does seem very engaged with queer culture and queer women's culture in a way that I found very entertaining and very, very enjoyable, frankly. I mean, it was interesting. I noticed that in the screening that I went to, you know, I was in a room with mostly blokes who are a bit older, a few women, but not many. And there were a few gags or sort of references where I was the only one laughing. That happened a few times. And I was like, oh, interesting. You know, I'm not here to defend every, you know, some of these gags really do fall flat, unfortunately. But I can't write it off. I thought its engagement and appreciation of queer female sexuality was just very fun and very free and very kind of non-judgmental on both sides. It's not judgmental on the Margaret Qualley character, who is very, you know, free sexually. And it's not judgmental towards Geraldine Viswanathan's character, who is much more restrained, you know. Also, cutting through all that, it's genuinely sexy. It's genuinely sexy, I found, and not in a way that I felt was exploitative, because, you know, my hackles were raised and kind of prepared for this to be a bit of a, you know, one for the boys, especially kind of engaging with the kind of sexploitation genre. But yeah, I actually really enjoyed that aspect of it. And I actually enjoyed it more than something like Bottoms, for example, which has been more heralded more as a kind of transgressive depiction of like female queer sexuality. But I actually connected much more with this in terms of that aspect, yeah.
I also enjoyed it more than Bottoms, and actually thought that, you know, one thing that absolutely does work is I completely bought that relationship between the two of them. They really pulled that off, and yeah, just the kind of friendship between them really made it work, and I thought they were both brilliant, actually.
It's true. I think they both kind of managed to be... there was a real sense of like a shared history between them, but I think they both managed to be kind of so charming that there wasn't ever really, it wasn't difficult to ever believe that they wouldn't want to spend time with each other, because I would quite like to spend time with both of them. We should get a move on, because we've got lots of other badly behaved women, I suppose, coming up. Laura, do you want to go first? In anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
In anticipation, probably a 4, because I, you know, I've enjoyed many Coen Brothers films. I like Margaret Qualley very much. I discovered her watching The Leftovers, where she played Justin Theroux's daughter, and she's just absolutely brilliant in that. And I've, you know, liked her ever since then. In enjoyment, probably a 3, bordering on a 4. I was a little let down by not being as funny as I'd hoped, but equally I found it very, you know, very zippy, very entertaining, extremely watchable. And in retrospect, again, probably a 3. It's not a film I will that it's not a film that stays with you. It is very throwaway, as you've said. But equally, I had a great, fun, sexy time with some like great actors. Like it was just a good time.
Fair enough, Darren. What about you?
Yeah, I think I'd completely echo that, actually. Four, I really liked the trailer in anticipation. Love the Coen brothers. I think in the moment it was a three. There was an older member of the press pack who came over to me at the end of the screening as we were walking out. It was not someone I'd met before. And she said to me, I keep thinking that the real film is about to start because Ethan Coen couldn't possibly have made that piece of shit. So I certainly didn't feel as kind of negatively as that. So it was a three for me in the moment. And then I agree, it was a three in retrospect. There's some lovely cameos to look out for as well, which we haven't discussed. But yeah, one in particular playing a real life figure who is worth Googling after you've watched the film.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that was a real life figure. I know who you mean there. Yeah, I think we're all basically on the same page of the 4-3-3. I do believe I got something. I think it's when I was interviewing Sarah Dosa for Fire of Love, and she said at a point you have to kind of break up the volcanoes and show some other stuff because you get volcano fatigue. I got dildo fatigue in this one, I gotta say. There was like just a point where I was just like, I can't react to another phallus.
See, I was just carefully trying to avoid the word dildo, and you're just talking about dildo fatigue, so I should have just gone for it.
But yeah, we should move on to another film, Bennell and Adama.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Bennell and Adama are young adults who are desperately in love with each other and live in a remote village in northern Senegal. Bennell was married to Adama's brother, but when he died, Adama follows the local custom and marries his brother's widow. The pair plan to live separately from their families, but when Adama refuses to fulfill his birthright to serve as the village's future leader and a drought hits, chaos ensues in the community. But before we get into the film, here is the wonderful director, Ramata Tuli C, in conversation with David Jenkins.
I'd love to know what, since that kind of grand premiere in Cannes, what has the last 8 months been like for you?
Yeah, it was crazy. It's been already 8 months, and I traveled all around the world with the movie. Yeah, the movie is like everywhere, and a lot of festival, a lot of release in different countries. So yeah, it's great. I think it's great for African movie, you know, to go to present and show what we can do now, you know, mm-hmm. the new generation and everything.
And what has been the reaction to the film in Senegal, in Africa? And how have people responded, and what have people been saying to you about it?
Yeah, really good. It was weird because I was a little bit afraid about, you know, the reception in Senegal with the character of Bennell. You know, she's a little bit mean, crazy and violent, and, you know, like not like the kind of woman you know, they learned to be in Africa and Senegal. So I was a little bit scared, but weirdly, people really loved the film, and the reception from everyone was like very good. And even the culture minister really loved the character of Banel. And I think it's great. And it says a lot about, you know, how Africa is changing now.
And how is it changing? Do you feel that there is more of a film industry there now, and like a way for people, younger directors to make movies?
Yeah. There is a new generation of African filmmakers. And you saw that in Cannes. In Cannes, with Baloji, with Asmae, with like a lot of people. And I think it's not just there are a lot of new director, but also a new narrative. And I think it's really important. And we saw that few weeks ago, Mati Diop won again at Berlin. And so with everything around Africa in the festival and in the big ceremony, and it's meant a lot for Africa. It's changing, I think. We are not going to talk about anymore about Semben and, you know, Djibril Mbeki Diop. We are going to talk about new people and young people.
Are people like Semben and Mbeki, do they still have a very big influence and in the kind of culture in Africa? And what's your relationship to their films?
I can't say for and tell for other, but I'm gonna say it personally. I really love those two directors. They are great African and Senegalese director with great movie, but I never took inspiration from them, to be honest, because I didn't grow with their movie. I just watched their movie recently. But I think when I, you know, watch interview from Semben, I think it's really inspiring for me, you know, to hear that he had the same struggle as me, you know, and he lived a few years ago and I live today, but we have the same struggle that we want to change the opinion that people have with Africa, you know.
Mm-hmm. What was your kind of experience growing up in terms and your relationship with film? And do you remember how you kind of entered into that world?
Yeah, with Blockbuster. Because when I was young, I didn't go a lot in cinema because my parents don't come from this culture, you know. And so we watch a lot of those kind of movie in television, you know, the Saturday night and Sunday night.
Yeah.
and I watch a lot of Terminator and Indiana Jones and Back to the Future and Sister Act with Whoopi Goldberg. And even the Ten Commandments. I don't know if the same name in English.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I grew up with those kind of movies. So I really like entertainment in cinema. I know that now I'm doing like very auteur and very indie movie. But like I really learn cinema with those movies.
That's interesting you say that, because I think in this film there is a sense that you want to move into that direction and do these bigger things, like the big sandstorm, like I'd love to know as well, like, because I understand you went to you learned the craft of filmmaking at La Femme, and which is like a very prestigious film school. And what kind of things were they teaching you there, and did you feel that like there were things that were missing?
But at La Femme, I was in the screenwriting department.
Right.
Not at the directing department. So I didn't learn to write, because I don't think we can learn to write. I think at La Femme, they learn us to find our voice, our own voice. And I think it's that I learned at La Femme, because at the beginning at La Femme, I was always writing some naturalists movie, like very political, but I didn't like that. And at the end, I learned to be honest with myself. I love Tell. I love Harry Potter. I love, you know, big movie. So, but I also love indie movies. So I learned to be coherent, you know, with myself and find a way to put everything, you know, in one movie, in one stuff.
What kind of things were they teaching you in the screenwriting class? Was there any classes that you found particularly kind of inspirational?
We don't have class. Yeah, it's a very specific school because we don't have class. We have to write one script every year, and it's 4 years.
Right.
And we don't have class.
Is that a feature or a? Or...
No, feature.
Yeah, okay.
With a lot of, short movie and a TV show. So we write a lot.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot. And we don't have class. We don't have theoretical class and lesson. We just write. They gave us an assignment, so like commission. This year you're gonna write about a girl in a pool, and we can write everything we want.
Right.
And it's just like that. And at the last year, we are completely free to write everything we want. And Banelit Adama, it's my script from my last year.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
And from that time that you wrote it, did it change much?
Not a lot. Not a lot. I think it's more the end that changed.
Okay. I'd love to know, it's been interesting reading interviews with you talking about the character of Banel a lot.
Yeah.
And how, you know, there is, I guess, a sort of, she's not an instantly likable character.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not my interpretation, but that's an interpretation. I wonder if I could ask you a bit about Adama, because you haven't talked as much about his character, but you know, he's equally difficult, I think. And I'd love to talk about how you came up with him.
At the beginning, when I start to write the script at La Fémis, it was the story of Banel and Adama, you know? And I think it's that change, you know, during the shooting and after that. Now it's more the story of Banel.
Mm-hmm.
But at the beginning, it was Banel and Adama. You know, it was really important. And Adama had also voiceover.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, the voiceover of Adama, you know, exists anymore. But I don't think if it's Adama, it's as difficult as Banel.
I guess his absence is is very kind of, you know, inspirational for Banel.
Yeah, but I think the difference between Adama and Banel is Adama is normal, I mm-hmm. think. And Banel, she's not human. Yeah, Adama is human. Mm-hmm. And Banel, she isn't human. And I think is that the difference. And yeah, I think the story of Banel and Adama, it's Banel really believed that Adama was like her, mm-hmm. like different. But at the end, she understood that no, he's normal. He's mm-hmm. like his mother. He's like his family. He's like his community. And it's for that she's decided to go to the house alone.
Were the characters based on anyone that you knew or yourself? Or
Banel or Adama or both?
Or both, yeah.
Me, both.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. But that's weird because when I start to write this movie, I was like, I'm more Adama than Banel.
Right.
Because I was so afraid to admit that I was more Banel than Adama. So, but yeah, I think I am both, because I think Adama took from me the struggle and between the community and the individualism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's my struggle because I was born in France from a Senegalese family and tradition and culture. And it's true that I struggled a lot when I was a teenager, you know, to find just a place
mm-hmm.
Between those two cultures. And I think that's the struggle of Adama. And for Banel, yeah, Banel is like, I'm Banel. I can have a t-shirt with I am Banel, you know. I don't kill people and I don't kill animals. But I think I really try to find my way to be a woman in that world like Banel.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And I understand that you have a kind of grounding in quite classical literature and drama as well. So were those things inspirational when you were writing?
Yeah, of course. Of course. I really love literature. It's like my first passion before cinema. And I really love those kind of characters like Medea, mm-hmm. Phèdre, Antigone, and Lady Macbeth too. And you know, that complex woman deep woman and sometimes mean and woman. And I really wanted to create an African character, female character like this, because I never seen one on, you know, in cinema. So yeah, I really took inspiration from literature, tragedy, and also author like Toni Morrison with the magical realism, and Maya Angelou with the poetry, with those voiceover. Yeah.
Amazing. I'm wondering if, I guess for me, the thing that kind of makes this drama happen is that is this context of the village in which it takes place, and the people in the village and their kind of influence of tradition and behavior, and you know that it, I guess it sort of pushes Banel and Adama down the path that they go. And I'd love to know how did you discover these villages and how did you decide on the place, the specific place where this film was shot?
As I told you, I'm French and Senegalese, and I was born in France and raised in France, but from Senegalese parents.
Yeah.
And sometime I went to vacation in Senegal, and my mom and my dad came from those village and this region, the Fouta region, at the north of Senegal, at 8 hours from Dakar. So I really, yeah, I know this kind of village without electricity, you know, small village, small community where tradition is really important. And I really grew up in this tradition and culture, even in France, when I was at home. Our home was, and it still is, very traditional.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And what was it like? Where was the actual place that you filmed?
It's like, it's not the village of my parents. It's like at the west of this region, and my parents come from the east of this region, because I wanted to be far from family and community.
Right. Knowing what you've just told me, like, what do your parents think of the film?
You know, my parents never went to cinema before that. You know, my father lived in France since the 60s, and my mother the 80s. But it's not in their tradition and their culture to go to cinema. They never been to a cinema since.
Wow.
Never in France.
Especially in France, where it's such a big thing.
Yeah, they never been. So it was the first time with my movie.
Wow.
They didn't go to Cannes, but it was when the movie was released in France, they went. And it was so weird because, you know, in this culture, as you can see in the movie, they don't talk a lot, you know. So my mom just came back and just said, Banel, she's really mean. Yeah. And that's it. And my father didn't say anything.
Oh,
but
wow.
It's normal. It's like very normal.
I'd love to know what they're thinking.
Me too.
Yeah.
One day I want
especially
to know.
Especially if like it could say so much about you and your feelings.
But I really knew that my mom won't like the character of Banel. I think Banel is her worst nightmare.
Right.
Yeah. But I think she's a little bit afraid because she knows that I wrote this script. So I wrote the character of Banel. So I think she's asking herself, is my daughter like Banel? And something. I think she's a little bit scared. But my father, no, I really want to know.
Or does she see herself as one of the villagers, maybe?
I think my mother really liked the character of the mother.
Right, okay.
Yeah, of course. of course, it's like Banel, she's mean, and the mother is right. And yeah.
I'd love to ask a little bit about the language that the film is done in. And I understand it's like a dialect, a sort of Senegalese dialect.
Yeah.
And yeah, how did that sort of figure into the writing process? And is that a language you knew?
Yeah, because you know, as I said, I grew up in a very traditional and cultural home, even if I was raised in France. So I understand and I talk this language. This is Fulani. But I wrote this screenplay in France, in French, obviously. And after that, I translate the script. But yeah, you can see that it was thought, pensé, it was thought with this language, mm-hmm. because at a few moments in my movie, it's really silent. Mm-hmm. And as I said, in this culture, and we don't talk a lot. So if someone wants to say something, sometimes they speak with their body mm-hmm. or their eyes or, you know, and not the language. Mm-hmm. And you can see that in this.
Last thing then, do you have any other movies to make?
Not yet.
Not yet.
Yeah, I have to think first.
But no scripts from La Femme that you're...
I have a lot of scripts.
Ah, okay, that's good. That's handy.
Yeah, but But I don't think... I think I grew up because La Femme was a long time ago, you know, and I think I change, you know, in 10 years. Mm. You grow and...
I guess after the success of this film as well, you maybe would be able to do something different and new. And
Maybe also. Maybe not... too different, but I just know that it won't be in Africa.
Right. Okay, then. Interesting. Well, thank you so much for
your
time.
Thank you to you.
So, Darren, another wonderful film from a Senegalese woman following in the steps of Mati Diop, who had Dahomey this year, and Alice Diop, who had the wonderful Saint Omer recently. Do you think Ramata Thulisi's film kind of puts her in similar standing?
I would say yes, with some reservations. I mean, the thing I would say about this film that is easily the most sort of striking thing about it, and this is the case from the opening seconds, is it's so beautifully shot. I mean, it's just an absolute thing of beauty. And I think the performances that she's got from her lead, so I believe that all of the actors are non-professionals here, are kind of extraordinary, really. And it's a very sort of lyrical, kind of languid type of film. You know, there's sort of something of the kind of Terrence Malick about it, actually. And it takes its time, even though it's not a long film. And I can't say I was sort of entirely riveted throughout, but that could well be more to do with me than the film. But for a debut feature, it was really, really impressive. And I think she's only done one short before. And I was looking it up to see whether she'd actually, that this was a short film that she turned into a feature. Because I would say my biggest problem with it was that I felt it got quite repetitive, and actually it didn't quite feel like it had enough to sustain a feature. So I thought I would look it up and discover that this was a short film, but it wasn't. I think the short film she made was something completely different.
Yeah, I mean, as much as it is gentle, I some solid plot twists in there as well. Like none of which I saw coming, which perhaps is my assumption was with kind of a piece of African cinema, is that maybe it's going to be a little bit kind of worthy and kind of all speaking of the horrors of colonialism. So it was actually, I think it's a lot more fun than I expected it to be. What about you, Laura? Did you kind of enjoy this trip into northern Senegal?
I absolutely love this. I thought this was brilliant. This was a little bit of not exactly a surprise, because I knew it won a prize in Cannes. Although, you know, winning a prize at a big festival doesn't always result in a film that's actually enjoyable to watch. But this was such a stunner for me. I thought, you know, obviously, yeah, the thing you first engage with is how visually beautiful it is. Oh my God. But I just found it like thematically very, very rich as well. You know, there's passion, there's, you know, rebelling against tradition, engagement with the climate crisis, misogyny, society. I also really loved what I kind of interpreted as almost an element of like folk horror, which I absolutely love, of like, don't dig that thing up because bad things will happen, which is such a like trope of folk horror. And, you know, I think recently discourses about folk horror have managed to get away from the kind of very Eurocentric kind of British association and you know, consider them in a more sort of global, on a more global scale, and how those relate to sort of folk tales and stories from around the world. So, and for context, in terms of the digging, the couple want to live in these houses that have been buried by enormous kind of sandstorms. They're buried in sand dunes. So this kind of ongoing project the two of them have been engaging in is trying to dig out these houses that they'll live in. And it's this dream
this sort of utopian vision of them as an independent couple, but they are kind of warned by various people in the village that those houses are cursed and you should leave them be. And what I found so intriguing is that this drought that occurs, that is the kind of main sort of thrust of the story, the film doesn't state as such that that is a kind of punishment or consequence of digging up those houses, of disturbing them, or of Adama refusing to take up the mantle of village chief. You know, there's a few elements at play. Plus also, you know, as we know, you know, this drought could just be the result of climate change. The film is careful not to dictate that any of those things are the definitive cause. And I think that's what I found rich about it. I found like so many different threads and ideas, but the film manages to not be kind of overcrowded. It is quite spare and quite sparse. Yeah, I just found it fascinating.
In a strange way, it actually reminded me of The Curse, the Nathan Fielder, Benny Safdie series that just aired, because in a very, very similar way, you know, in the first episode of that series, a little girl says to the Nathan Fielder character, "I curse you," and you spend the remaining 10 episodes. Has he been cursed? Or, you know, is this just a little girl mucking around doing a thing she's seen online? And actually, obviously, the climate change and houses, you know, it was covering a lot of the same areas, obviously, in a completely different way. You know, a show with Nathan Fielder, Benny Safdie and Emma Stone is going to be very, very different to what's happening here. But I felt like there was a weird kind of thematic overlap between those two things.
Oh, yeah, no, that's fascinating. I mean, yeah, I laughed out loud several times, I must say. But the thing that, you know, I kind of grew up in Sudan and like I'm quite used to, like, once a year you get a sheep as a pet for about 3 weeks, and at the end of it you eat the sheep. So like kind of things around animals being dispatched with doesn't bother me in a way that I know some people find extremely disturbing. Those were the biggest gasps from the screening that I saw. People seem to really struggle with seeing animals being killed in such a brutal way.
God, that's bizarre, I gotta say. I mean, well, I don't know, people can be very sensitive for animals, but yeah, that surprises me as well. I don't know how many people in that room are meat eaters, but they can't bear to see a cow coming to a bad end. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, I guess it's one of those things where what was nice about this is it did feel like it had quite a lot of cultural specificity, but I think you could kind of come in with absolutely no ideas about what life was like in northern Senegal and really not struggle to kind of grasp the important elements of the story. Part of that, I think, is down to quite a clever script where you have these kind of meeting of the important people of the village who, you know, can just lay out, I mean, like, well, this is what's happened and this is what we expect to happen going forward, and this is the way in which you are not doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so rich with those societal expectations and the roles that you have to play. And yeah, the script is amazing in the way that it manages to make all that extremely clear without exposition dumping or sort of laying out the quote unquote rules of the place. It's just in simple conversation between characters that these things become clear. And yeah, helped by the absolutely amazing performance. I mean, I think her name is Katie Main. Apologies for any mispronunciation as banal. She is, God, she's amazing. What an incredible face, and so much kind of vulnerability and fury. And yeah, she's just astonishing. And I hope she appears in more films, because she blew me away.
Yeah, and I'm a really firm believer in the idea that the specific is the universal. So I actually thought what they had to say about the expectations of a woman within that particular sort of culture and society, it just felt as relevant to anyone basically anywhere in the world. I thought that was probably the thing I liked the most about it, and what was expected actually of both of them at times within the film, and them not wanting to do these things and wanting to carve out their own thing. Yeah, I thought it was really well done, that aspect.
No, I am a really big fan of this. I'm very excited to kind of see what she does next. It does feel like perhaps in the way, you know, as when it came to like African cinema or black cinema, or, you know, any cinema from like minorities, you would get promising debuts and then not much. Like building momentum seemed to be so much harder within this industry, but I'm hopeful for a brighter future. That's like weirdly optimistic of me. That very rarely happens. Shall we get some scores on this? Laura, do you want to go first? In anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
In anticipation, yeah, didn't know an awful lot about this going in, other than that it won a prize in Cannes. And I'm glad that I didn't know too much going in, actually. So I'd say a 3 in anticipation. In enjoyment, definitely a 4. I just found it really gripping, really involving, so visually beautiful. And I truly didn't know where the story was going, and almost don't want to talk too much about that, because, you know, go in fresh, go in knowing only that there are a couple in love in Senegal and nothing else. And in retrospect, yeah, 4, as you can tell, I'm really enthusiastic about this film, and I think it's such an exciting new voice in cinema. Yeah,
and lovely that it's actually getting a major cinema release in the UK. Darren, what about you?
Yeah, so it won't be identical again this time. So I think anticipation was 3. I didn't know much about it, but I had kind of had a sense that it was sort of reasonably well received. Then my enjoyment, I would say 3 again. And yeah, I think it would be a 3 in retrospect as well. I quite enjoyed how different it was from Drive Away Dolls. It was nice to get 2 new releases that are getting relatively wide releases that were just like entirely different and put you in a completely different headspace. But yeah, I think 3's across the board for me.
Yeah, I am going to probably be a 4's across the board. I thought, again, it is so gorgeous that, like, just the enjoyment is there. Even if very little had happened, I think I would have been at a 4. But I loved it. I think it was unpredictable and interesting. I think as a character study of just Benel alone, it kind of, it, you know, warrants a 4. And yeah, in retrospect, 4 too. I'm very excited to see what she does next, and I think I'm going to rewatch this. Next up, we're going to get into Film Club. In Bad Girls Go to Hell, Meg is a Boston housewife who is sexually assaulted by a custodian in her apartment building. Killing him during the attack, she flees to New York City. She is then befriended by a series of people with whom she becomes emotionally and sexually involved, all the while trying to evade a narrowing police dragnet. So, Laura, first time to Bad Girls Go to Hell?
Yes, it was. I've never seen anything like this before. I don't think I've ever seen an exploitation / sexploitation film before. I think the closest thing I'd come to is recently I saw the documentary about the Scala cinema in King's Cross. And obviously that was, you know, exploitation was the bread and butter of that cinema. You know, many clips in that great documentary of all of these kinds of films. But yeah, so this is my first excursion into this world kind of directly. And, you know, I would say, frankly, this film is more of a curio, more of a kind of sort of, I don't want to say museum object, that sounds harsh, but it very much of its time and of its moment. Although, as I'm sure we'll talk about, with more kind of radical overtones, or undertones rather, with more kind of radical undertones beneath the surface, that's quite sort of cheap and scuzzy.
Well, yeah, 1965, it was a very different world back then. I mean, what do you view in it as being radical in terms of undertones or overtones?
Undertones or overtones, wombling free, etc. I mean, I suppose the kind of, it depicts a world in which the patriarchy is always out to get you in one way or another, I suppose, is what I'm saying in summary, you know, and that at the beginning of the film, the character Meg is desperate for her husband to stay at home. You know, it's a Saturday, he has to go to the office, she wants him to stay and he won't, and he's so, you know, peak sort of 60s, he's very dismissive, and, you know, and she clearly wants him to stay because she wants to have sex with him. Like, she is showing, you know, expressing her sexual desire, and it feels like she is then punished for that, but she is so obviously a figure of sympathy that the story she is punished, but the film isn't punishing her, if you see what I mean, you know. And the only person that's nice to her is the lesbian in the strange sort of body stocking outfit
thing who she briefly goes to live with and has a fairly nice time. And other than that, it's... and she also goes to work for a older lady as sort of as her kind of companion slash carer. And, you know, again, that's all fine. But any man she encounters is dangerous and should be avoided at all costs. And, you know, I'm not saying it's the most radical message in the world, but relatively for 1965, I think it probably is.
Darren, what about you? Ahead of its time or kind of curio of the past?
Yeah, I mean, I came at this from a very similar perspective. I had never seen anything like this in my life. I mean, I think probably the closest I had seen was the films you got on Channel 5 on a Friday night before Newsnight Review came on. And I was kind of staggered by it. I mean, it opened up and I was sort of like, what is this? This is like Birdman or something. You've got this kind of jazzy soundtrack and there's these kind of long shots. And obviously, you know, she sort of flees to New York. And New York is presented in this way that I think is actually very true of New York, where the people seem either incredibly welcoming or absolutely insane. And sometimes they're both within the space of about 10 seconds. And you get into this kind of like strange cyclical structure where she keeps meeting people and, you know, then gets booted out and then she moves on to meet someone else. It was a real kind of like series of unfortunate events. But the thing which I found most surprising, and I wonder if I thought this because of the other films that we had to cover this week, which is Ethan Coen has obviously said that this is one of the influences, along with John Waters and other things, on Drive Away Dolls. But the ending of this film, which I won't give away because it is something of a kind of surprise ending, is almost identical to Inside Llewyn Davis. So I kind of wondered whether he'd actually been influenced by this in the past. Maybe it wasn't just his lesbian road movie. Maybe he's been influenced by this a decade ago as well. But it was such an odd kind of cartoonish. The performances are absolutely bizarre. The writing is so strange. But it is a curio, but it is definitely not without merit, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel like that is some real damning with faint praise. Not without merit.
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, I will always be happy to see a film that has a runtime of about 65 minutes or whatever it was. So that was definitely in its favour.
We've been very kind this week. Not a one of these cracks 19 minutes.
Yes, you're right. Yeah. But it was just such a strange experience because it was... It's very rare, you know, in my late 30s to come to a film with absolutely no frame of reference. You know, Ethan Coen can say this was a big influence on Drive Away Dolls. This is not similar to the experience of watching Drive Away Dolls. It is so different to anything that I've seen. It's kind of fascinating to me that it was a female writer-director who put this together, which obviously gives a very sort of different vibe, I guess, than what you would expect if it, you know, had been someone else from the era. But it's definitely interesting.
Yeah, I was reading about Doris Wishman. It's quite a hard name to say. Doris Wishman, who directed more than 30 films, most of them a bit like this. You know, she started in kind of the nudist genre. One of her most famous films is called Nude on the Moon. And like, my God, I gotta see Nude on the Moon. What a title. And, you know, she did porn, she did horror. Like, what an incredible, bizarre career. I'd never heard of her. And she just seems like a really fascinating figure.
Yeah, she does kind of seem the sort of person that lives in like this mythical New York where it's like her and Abel Ferreira and Nan Golding just all getting up to kind of like gloriously scuzzy things and making art out of it.
Yeah, she feels like the kind of person to me that would have like an absolutely incredible autobiography or a biopic made about her or a documentary made about her without you necessarily having to have seen a huge amount of the work, I guess.
Well, now you've finished the Pat Sharp book, maybe this is the next project. I'd read this.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, give me an excuse to watch Nudes on the Moon.
Right, well, before we wrap up, we should do our one last thing. You guys are going to give us a non-movie recommendation. Laura, do you want to go first? After watching three very short films this week, what do you recommend listeners seek out?
Well, it's an oldie but a goodie. It's, sticking to the kind of queer female theme of two of the films this week, I recently read The Member of the Wedding by Carson McCullers, which I'd never read before, 1946 novel. I believe it was her third novel. I'd read Heart is a Lonely Hunter during lockdown and finally got round to this. That is, it's just a stunning little novella about a sort of, I think she's about 12 years old, 12-year-old girl struggling on the kind of brink of adolescence to find her way in society. And I just thought it was absolutely brilliant. I read it on my train journeys up and down from Glasgow. And yeah, if you've never read Carson McCullers, you must, because just such an incredible, distinctive authorial voice. Absolutely loved it.
God, I must say, maybe I'm just getting kind of spoiled to my attention span is doing something, but when you put the A on the end, when it became novella, and I was just like, ooh, a short one, another short one. Fantastic.
It is nice and short, nice and lean, yeah.
Darren, what about you? What do you suggest people seek out?
Okay, so well, first of all, just very quickly, I mean, one is slightly film related, but it is not a film. So the BBC have recently put up an arena from the early 90s, which is a German filmmaker, Volker Schlondorf, interviewing Billy Wilder for 3 hours. It's in three parts, called How Did Billy Do It? And it's just Billy Wilder for 3 hours in his early 80s. Talking about his life and career. I think the chats were filmed in 1988, but it came out a few years later, and that is absolutely terrific. But my actual completely unfilm related thing, although it should be a film, is a book that I'm currently reading. It's from 2001. It's the debut novel by Glenn David Gold. It's called Carter Beats the Devil. And I'd always seen this in bookshops, loved the cover, and sort of fictionalizes the story of Carter the Great, who was an actual magician. And it's just incredible. Sort of, it came out around the same time as Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon, which is also a masterpiece. But yeah, I'm just loving it. It is not a novella. It is a chunky old book, but you sort of race through it. It reads like a novella in a way.
I have to say, I do have a slightly humiliating story connected to Carter Beats the Devil. When I was at uni in London, I decided that I wanted to meet more people. So I joined a book group that I found online. And the first meeting was Carter Meets the Devil. And I really enjoyed it. And then I think the Will Self novel was the second one. And I thought this book group had gone pretty well, but I arrived for the second meeting and not a single other person showed up. They'd all come to the first one and been like, absolutely not. So I sat there for like half an hour, keeping like checking the times, being like, surely I've got this, and surely Carter Meets the Devil meeting wasn't that bad. But no, all on my lonesome, got stood up by like seven people at the same time.
Oh God.
That is brutal. God,
sorry. I wouldn't have picked it if I'd known it would be so triggering.
No, it's a great book though. And you're right. I think it'd be a fantastic film. I mean, it's because it's got the magic elements and Freud's in it, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, and the Marx Brothers, all these figures sort of pop in and out of it. It's a really, really clever piece of work.
Shame on them for not appreciating it more, because yeah, no. Very good recommendation. Thank you very much. So if you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Next week, we'll be looking at new releases, The Delinquents and Immaculate, and returning to Black Narcissus for Film Club. Thanks very much for tuning in. And if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leigh Latif, and my guests this week were Laura Venning and Darren Richmond. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankus.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms.
Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.